All right, let's go ahead and begin. My name is Rob Williams, and I've been a sixth grade teacher at the Region School of Austin for the previous 8 years. And this being the last session of the day, I'm sure you're tired, thinking about dinner, thinking about different forms of entertainment that you can partake in this evening. And so I'll do my best to try to help you pay attention. I'm used to instructing children that have the propensity to daydream a tad bit. So, my goal today is twofold. To begin with, I want to build a case for the importance of science, how a study of science enhances and sharpens one's thinking skills, and how it can greatly expand our understanding of the glory of God and the subsequent worship of God. Additionally, I want to build a case for studying science, not just in regards to a certain age group or grade, but to all people, students, and teachers. And yes, I classify all people under those two headings, because we are all students. No one but God is omniscient. Thus, none of us has exhaustive knowledge, even in regards to our own specialty. How many of us have come to the conclusion that the more we learn, the more we realize that we don't know what we thought we did when we were more ignorant? Anybody? And most of us are teachers, whether we have official pedagogical training or not. Anyone that has children or works with children is a teacher. The second part of my talk, I want to give you some ideas on how you can cultivate a classroom atmosphere which fosters intrigue and wonder about the created world, such that your students would desire perhaps another helping of the meal that you have set before them. Life in 2005, for many, is a fragmented frenzy. We are pushed and pulled by the needs and demands of our family, work, church, and health. And there seems to be little sanctuary, little respite from all these things clamoring for our time and for our energy. Because of the advances in technology, most of us come with a cell phone fashionably affixed to our hip, allowing us the luxury and the curse of always being available, always within reach. And our daily planners, electronic or the archaic paper type like I use, divide our day into segments, each segment representing a task to be tackled. And even during times of relaxation, as some have more aptly described it, are times of decompression, many find it difficult to disconnect from our frenetic culture. The most popular leisure activities appear to be watching television or taking in a movie. Hardly activities that allow one to disconnect from the culture. There are many destructive consequences to this pace of living, detrimentally affecting the mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical state. But in my opinion, one of the most dire consequences of this rapid-fire culture has been the loss of wonder for the created world and a reverence for God. A high-paced culture encourages us to take for granted the created world in which we inhabit. It's as though we're on a Ferris wheel, spinning so rapidly that everything surrounding us, landscapes, cloud formations, sunsets, the animal kingdom, is nothing but a blur of colors. This blur simply becomes white noise to our high-paced lives. Few slow down and even fewer stop the wheel to consider and ponder their surroundings. Many take little notice of the miraculous, incredibly engineered and lovingly designed created order that beckons to us every day as a witness to the Lord? How often are we wowed and awed by the created order? How often do we walk outside, observe the sun, and think, "Wow, now that's quite bizarre. There, out in the void of space, is a giant sphere of hydrogen gas in which nuclear fission and fusion are constantly occurring. I'm basically looking at thousands of nuclear bombs being detonated every day, transmitting light and warmth to the Earth, causing life to flourish." If we are honest with ourselves, most of us take something like the sun for granted. I'm not intrigued by the fact that there is a giant nuclear fireball visible to me every single day. But imagine that you somehow existed in a sunless environment. No natural light, no natural warmth, all darkness and cold. Now, I know that's not possible, but track with me. Then one day, a celestial sphere appears. Would you not be mesmerized, shocked, perhaps bedazzled? Would you not ask, "Where did it come from? Who created it? And exactly, what is it?" And after posing these questions, would you not have reverence for the designer and the engineer of such a marvel as our sun? But you see, in a culture that seldom downshifts, or more specifically, puts life in neutral, wonders such as the sun are taken for granted. Careful observation and reflective thought about the world in which we inhabit becomes a rarity, perhaps relegated only to the annual vacation. But what would happen if we did begin to look at the created order with a childlike curiosity? What would happen if we became astute observers of the world in which we live and then thought deeply about our observations? Would it not have substantial positive effects on our life, our thinking skills, and our faith? It is for these reasons that I am an advocate of us all becoming students, or as I like to call it, careful observers of our environment. What would it be like for someone to live with curious abandonment for God's created world? A person with such a mentality might have the following thoughts during a typical day. When he awakens in the morning, he might think, "Ah, I'm alive. And I'm alive because of an incredibly powerful liquid pump located behind a protective shield of bone in my chest. This pump is constantly pushing fluid through my entire body. Inside the fluid is carried a substance called hemoglobin, which picks up oxygen from the lungs and conveys it down a vast array of highways, exits, rural roads, and alleyways so that each of the trillions of mini supercomputers called cells can be provided with oxygen in order to repair and regulate the essential functions of each of my body's organs. Each of these cells is performing functions that he is not aware of, and even when he is made aware of them, he does not come close to completely comprehending how they function." I tell my students all the time, you've got involuntary muscle actions going all over your body. Are you thinking about your heartbeat? Like, no. You know, can you imagine if you had to consciously make your heart beat? 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, for most guys, they couldn't do that because they have a very difficult time multitasking. They have tunnel vision, you know. So, what'd you eat last night? 1, 2. Well, I had prime rib. You'd have to get the defibrillators out every day in class. Our hypothetical friend ponders further. It's though I am living on a technically advanced space station maintained by trillions and trillions of workers. My job on the space station is to just sit and exist. When I first came on board, I didn't understand what the engineers, the physicists, the biologists, the chemists, the machinists, the repair crews, the laundry department,
the cleaning crews, the galley crew, or the waste management crew on board the station did every second, every day, so that I could simply sit and exist. But one day our fictitious friend queries, what exactly makes life on this space station possible? And it's at this point that he begins to examine what the personnel aboard the station are doing. The more he learns about all the different responsibilities, all the little jobs that must be accomplished each day, the more he is amazed at the symphony of all the component parts of the station eloquently maintaining life. By his observations and studies, he is awed. After he has woken up and considered his circulatory system, he might contemplate how it is possible for him to get out of bed and walk down the hall to the kitchen. He is astonished when he contemplates that his body is supported by an internal semi-rigid structure composed of 206 separate pieces called bones, which are strong enough to support organs and muscle, but light enough so as not to overburden those muscles. The ratio of great strength to lightweight is achieved by the design of the bone itself. The inside of the bone is made of trusses, which, with hollow spaces in between, the type of design engineers utilize when creating something such as an airplane wing. That must be very strong, but also very light. Such an incredible design must involve an incredible designer. From here, perhaps, he wonders how he is able to see his way to the kitchen. He is dumbfounded when he considers all that occurs every millisecond so that he can see. Incoming light passes through his convex lenses, projecting an inverted miniature photo image on the retinas. Photosensitive receptors on the retinas, called rods and cones, are bombarded by light photons, causing a chemical reaction, resulting in a signal being sent through the optic nerve to the brain. The brain receives the signal and reconstructs it back into a picture analogous to how a binary code printed on a DVD is read by a DVD player and translated to a television image. And finally, as our friend eats his stack of blueberry pancakes, he is perplexed by all the involuntary functions that are occurring so that carbohydrates, proteins, and other important chemicals can be extracted from his food. As moistened and grinded bits of pancake enter his stomach, they are massaged and pulverized by a Schwarzenegger-like muscle while being coated by hydrochloric acid, sprayed by thousands of tiny jets aligning the stomach wall. The stomach muscle is protected by the harmful effects of the acid, which can turn metal into mush, by a thin mucous membrane. The broken down food now passes into the intestines, where it is given a shower of intestinal juices to neutralize the acid. Nutrients like glucose are absorbed to be used by the body while the rest is passed out. And our fictitious observer is baffled because of the fact that all this happens apart from his volition or comprehension. In fact, he realizes that if anything went wrong with his heart, eye, or digestive system, he would not have the ability to function. After contemplating just a minute fraction of what his body does every single day, he is overwhelmed by the grace and grandeur of his body machine, humbled by the wisdom and intelligence of its designer, realizing that Paul's words from the book of Romans attest to what he has just experienced. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. This is one of my goals in science, to produce an atmosphere that elicits from my students the characteristics of the fictitious observer. And if this is my goal, what practical steps can I take to create a classroom environment that encourages a student to think like this? How can I develop an appetite for science? How do I ignite curiosity in my students? How can I get them to think about what they observe? In short, how do I make my science class come alive? Well, we must begin with ourselves, becoming students of science, astute observers of the world in which we inhabit. For when we begin to learn or refresh our memories about science, our teaching will become infused with life. If we don't first enjoy science, our students will readily perceive it. This is true of any field of education. If you don't have a passion and a love for the subject that you are teaching, you will be instructing strictly from a curriculum. Your teaching will be dull. You've probably experienced classroom environments that had about as much life as a flat Coke. You've also, I'm sure, experienced classes that were effervescent. What made the difference? No doubt a major contributing factor was the passion the instructor had for his or her subject matter. When you as a teacher know a great deal about a subject or are in the process of learning new information, what is the result? Let me ask you this question. What do teachers want to do when they learn something new? Teach it, right? They can't help it. When they read something intriguing or they generate a new lesson, they can hardly wait for the school day to begin in order to share the wealth with the students. And how rewarding it is when the lesson goes as you anticipated it would. Many times they don't. This being the case, the best teachers are those who are still students, always reading, always questioning, always pondering, always observing, and always hungering for more. And when a teacher is passionate and excited about something, it really does retard the growth of apathy in the classroom. Additionally, when an instructor continues to broaden his base of knowledge, he is then free to teach, rather than remaining affixed to the podium where his outline or teacher's notes lie. He is able to walk around the classroom, taking questions, going off on tangents, and integrating information. This is the complete opposite of the teacher whose knowledge of a subject is restricted to his notes. He fears leaving the podium or taking questions. Rather than engage the class and encourage speculations and questions, this teacher merely hopes to rush through the information without looking inept before his class. And if a student really doesn't grasp a concept, the teacher is hard-pressed to come up with an illustration or analogy to illumine the student's understanding. For example, part of our science curriculum is having the students perform nature studies, where they observe something outside and record their observations in a sketchbook by drawing a picture and writing a short paragraph. So when I learned that I would have to teach students to do a nature study, I thought it would be a wise decision to do some nature studies on my own. And so I did. I chose to begin my studies by learning about insects, for the simple fact that I have always been intrigued by these machine-like organisms that have the ability of flight and fascinating devices for protection. I began to read, and soon I was hooked. I learned about insects that I frequently observed in Austin. One of the first insects I learned about was the mud dauber, because we had them all over campus. And I learned that the female steers while in flight by moving her abdomen. She gathers mud from the edges of puddles, mixes the mud with her saliva to make a type of cement. She lays down the cement with her jaws, which she uses as a trowel. She forms smooth, hollow tubes in the mud where she will lay her eggs. The tubes are filled with spiders that the dauber paralyzes. For the food, must be kept fresh. No refrigerators in those dauber homes. It's amazing how the dauber performs an aerial attack on the spider without being bitten by the spider. It flies the sun spider back to the tubes, placing it in what will become the spider's sarcophagus. Once each tube is filled with 3 to 4 spiders, the mother dauber lays an egg on top of the paralyzed arachnids and then seals up the tube. Soon, the mud dauber egg hatches and a little hungry grub emerges with a voracious appetite. Fortunately, his magnanimous mother has provided him with a substantial supply of spider meat. Eaten alive by a baby. Now tell me, would this not fascinate the boys in your class? Now what's going to happen if when you are walking back to your hotel or back to your car this evening and you see a mud dauber nest? Might you not stop and observe it? Why today and not yesterday? Because you have been given a small bit of information about the creature and it has triggered your curiosity. You see, the way I first did nature studies was the complete opposite of what I have just done with you. I gave my students hardly any preliminary knowledge. I merely told them that they were going to do a nature study because it was in the curriculum, and that's what classical Charlotte Mason-y schools do. And so I gave the students some nice paper, a pencil, and proceeded to instruct them to attend to nature and behold something wondrous. And so they went outside, and I was soon dismayed by their facial expressions. You know the look. This is ridiculous. Boring. What's the point, Mr. Williams? Of course, I was oblivious to the fact that I was displaying that same look as well. After about 15 minutes, I ambled around to observe the fruits of my inspiring directives. It was pathetic. The students didn't care. They thought this was a pointless activity. Some were observing rocks, producing drawings of a flat, half-shaped oval. Some were drawing stick trees. But most were throwing blades of grass and pelting each other with small pebbles. My nature study was an utter and complete failure. Where had I gone wrong? I had given them no direction, no details about anything they might observe. I wasn't excited about the activity because I had no knowledge about what my students might observe. They could perceive that I didn't care about the activity, and so they acted in like manner. My students had no guidance, no reference for anything they saw, and the result was apathy, both from the students and their teacher. After the experience, I was in no way excited about having another nature study time in the near future. But what would have occurred if I had given them some information about pill bugs, as they're sometimes called, doodlebugs? What if I had told them that doodlebugs are not insects? They are arthropods, but they're actually crustaceans, very similar to shrimp, having a breathing mechanism more closely related to gills. They absorb oxygen easier from the water. That's why they are always found in moist places. If they are trapped in a hot area, they begin to panic and act erratically, for they associate elevated Fahrenheit to an arid environment. I found this out when I put one on top of a hot overhead, which I didn't do in front of the students, but I just wanted to see what would happen. Terrible, isn't it? Now, I tell the students to go and observe some pill bugs and observe what they do when they are in place in the middle of some hot pavement. I ask them questions such as, how long do they remain in a defensive ball before unrolling? Now my students have information which aids them in knowing what to look for. Makes all the difference in the world. See, to inspire students about science, you must become what you want them to become. Students of science. Broaden your knowledge. Become a student of science and never stop learning. My second recommendation is to develop engaging lessons. T. teaching is not entertainment. But that does not mean that material has to be presented insipidly because the teacher fails to allot adequate time for lesson preparation. I have teachers say all the time, well, I'm not very creative. That might be true, but I think most of the time it's, I really haven't sat down, read this, assimilated it, ruminated over it. I haven't given the appropriate time to let that creativity rise to the surface. To illustrate this point, I'm going to present two short science lessons that I've used which have proven effective. Now, at the beginning of the year in sixth grade, we teach matter and the theory of atoms, or the idea of atoms, not theory. And I started out by, and I got this idea from Sophie's World, if you've ever read the book, very enjoyable exploration of the world's philosophies in a very enjoyable manner. So I write the question up on the board. Can something come from nothing? Simple question. Can something come from nothing? And then what I do, which I love to do, is I sit down with the students and I just stare at it. And then I stare at them. And I stare back at the board and I stare at them. What do you think? What kind of question is that? And interact with them like a sixth grader would. Arrested development. Can something come from nothing? Finally, somebody cautiously raises his or her hand. I don't think so, Mr. Williams. I try to clarify their statement. Have you ever, in your experience, seen something come from nothing? Have you? Well, there was this magician one time, and, you know, the quarter thing. And finally, I get them to the conclusion that, no, obviously not. Something must have always existed. Some ancient philosophers, those guys that asked really tough questions about life, concluded that since something cannot come from nothing, then something has always existed. Meaning that matter, the stuff things are made of, has always existed. So I get them to agree on this point. And I go over it a number of times. So let me clarify. Let me ask you again. Can something come from nothing? No, sir. Are you sure about that? Yes, sir. No one's going to change their mind, are they? No, sir. Because there will be a great deduction if you do. And then I write this question on the board. Do we observe change in the world? Yes, things come into the world. Mr. Williams, I plant a tree, and it's a little sapling, and it gets bigger, and I'm changing, and the lunch I left in my locker at the beginning of the week, that's changing. And so we finally come to the conclusion as a class, yes, things change. Things come into the world, and things leave the world. Things grow and die. Then I throw this question out to him. Does this mean that something is coming from nothing? I thought we just concluded that something cannot come from nothing, but now it seems like stuff is coming out of nothing. When a seed sprouts and grows, it looks like new tree stuff is being formed, that it's coming from nothing. So now, my friends, my students, we have a problem. For we know that something cannot come from nothing. But we observe things coming into the world like babies and plants. It sure seems like something is coming from nothing. Where does all the stuff come from that one needs to make a plant? Now they're caught in this dichotomy. Right? Don't do this. Can we just go to recess? I pose another question. Why is the Lego one of the most ingenious toys ever invented? And then I have a giant bag of Legos, and I break them into teams of two, and I just put a pile of Legos on their desk. you've got the kids' attention. All I have to do is bring out the Legos, and they're transfixed. And I give them 15 minutes to make a plane. And the timer starts, and they're crafting and designing. And then I go around and look at their creations and make fun of them and hold up the winner. They all vote. And then I have two teams make a dog. Then I have two teams make a turtle. And then finally, the students love this, they get to basically make a scaled-down model of their teacher out of Legos. And invariably, this teacher is follically challenged. But at the end of this, I asked them the question once again, why are Legos do? And I just put a pile of Legos on their desk. You've got the kids' attention. All I have to do is bring out the Legos, and they're transfixed. And I give them 15 minutes to make a plane. And the timer starts, and they're crafting and designing. And then I go around and look at their creations and make fun of them and hold up the winner. They all vote. And then I have two teams make a dog. Then I have two teams make a turtle. And then finally, the students love this, they get to basically make a scaled-down model of their teacher out of Legos. And invariably, this teacher is follically challenged. But at the end of this, I asked them the question once again, why are Legos such great toys? Why do you guys love playing with Legos? Why do you start playing with Legos when you're 5 years old and you still play with them when you're 35 years old? I know. You buy them for your kids, right? Mm-hmm. And they'll finally come up with the idea that we love them because we can build numerous things. The only restriction is our own imagination. We can take little pieces of plastic and join them together to create thousands and thousands of different objects. And then I tell them a little bit about Democritus, an ancient philosopher, one of those guys that likes to ask tough questions about life. He thought it that maybe everything in the world is made up of tiny particles that are so small that they can't even be cut into pieces. He gave these particles the name atoms, which, kids, just means uncuttable. He thought that these tiny particles had always existed. That what we see as change in the world is nothing but a new arrangement of these little particles. It's just like when you build something out of Legos. Have the Legos changed, or did you just change the way in which they were arranged? Now the light bulbs begin to go on. My kids, Democritus, he was on to something. There are a small number of particles that we call atoms. Everything in the world is made up of these atoms. These atoms are called elements, and they are listed on a special table called the periodic table of elements. Everything you see is made up of one type or a combination of these atoms, and there are 102 different atoms listed on the periodic table. And here it is. I've connected something that is very, very abstract, the atomic world, to something that they understand. And this is one of the seven laws of learning that Gregory highlights. Whenever you're teaching something new, connect it with something the students already know, they already understand. And use something from their everyday experience. What kid doesn't know about Legos? A little bit later on in the year, teach about the different states of matter. And when we get to gases, I want the kids to understand the basic principle behind lift, flight. I want them to understand the Bernoulli principle. Now, I could just tell them the Bernoulli principle. I could just write it on the board. Okay? As the speed of fluid increases, its pressure decreases. Okay? And I'm going to get the glazed donut look. Do you all understand? Uh-huh. Never assume that your students understand. They say, how many passes does it take for a student finally to get a concept? I think most of the time the students aren't paying attention. A great activity to do, by the way, videotape yourself teaching and then sit down in a student desk and watch yourself. How long does it take you before you're doodling on a piece of paper and not paying attention to yourself? If you find yourself daydreaming and not paying attention to yourself, how much more will the students be prone to let their mind wander? It's a great, great self-diagnostic tool that I like to use all the time. And oh gosh, that was a bad illustration. I can't believe I said that. That doesn't even make sense. That's completely incomprehensible. So I want to teach them about the Bernoulli effect. And like I said, I could just write it up on the board. But I choose to do something else. I tell the kids, we've talked a little bit about low pressure and high pressure, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why things fly. Have you ever wondered that? Isn't it bizarre that something like a 747 can attain lift and actually fly? Does that not awe you just a little bit? And they love this because I proceed to pull out my hairdryer. It's been a long, long time since I used one of these. I think it was back in the 70s when I had my hair feathered. Remember that? I think that was the same time I was wearing my Kennington terry cloth shirts, wide collars. Don't laugh, they're coming back. Okay, so here's my hairdryer. I want to illustrate the Bernoulli effect. And so, I just do this in front of the kids. And I bounce it around. And of course, the kids are mesmerized. Like, you know, it looks like a scene out of Harry Potter. Mr. W, how are you doing that? I said, I have many powers. I'm about to change you into a newt. And I asked the kids, okay, what's going on here? The ping pong ball is staying centered over the hairdryer. It's as though there's some sort of invisible field. It's like an invisible cylinder, which is containing the ping pong ball. Now, what could create that invisible cylinder? What substances do we have to deal with up here? Nothing but air, correct? And the students say, yeah, there's nothing but air up here. Now, students, where do you think the high pressure might be? And it doesn't take them long to come to the conclusion that the high pressure is probably on the outside, because that's keeping the ping pong ball centered over the moving air of the hairdryer. Then I tell the kids, so if high pressure is around the outside of our invisible cylinder, then what type of pressure do you think is in the middle? Probably lower pressure. That's right. It's about this. What we have just observed. When air moves, when its velocity increases, what happens to its pressure? You just saw it. Oh, it gets lower. That's right. Now you know how lift is attained in an airplane. And I go into, you know, the design of the wing, the air moving over the top moves much more rapidly than the air underneath, and so there's the pressure difference, lower pressure on top, higher pressure on the bottom, and it's literally like, you know, an invisible giant pushing up the wings on the airplane, producing lift. I love to start off my science classes with just an experiment, and I don't tell the kids much about it. Another one of Gregory's laws is never teach something, never tell the students something that they can figure out on their own. And that is a temptation that is very difficult to avoid, because we as teachers, we have a natural inclination to want to tell a student how something works, right? But what do you recall? What do you remember more easily? Something that somebody told you or something that you figured out on your own? We remember what we figure out, right? You come across a little nugget of truth or something like that, it's much easier for us to recall. And it does a lot for their little self-esteem, too. And it encourages abstract thinking skills, critical thinking skills. So they can figure out what's happening. They get to discover, just like Bernoulli. And they'll memorize it and be able to recall it at a later time. In order to get students interested in science, you must create an interesting environment in which they are forced to participate by using their observation, thinking, and problem-solving skills. And when you do these things, when you become a student of science, you will be able to generate interesting lessons. Encouraging and motivating students to consider the incredible, as well as not robbing God of the worship that is due to Him for His magnificent creation. For that is one of the ways that we can worship God, to behold the glory that is manifested through all His created works, and then to express our awe to Him for all that He has graciously created and bestowed upon us as human beings. Thank you.